Hello and welcome to Canary Pod. I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at the Canary. This week, I'll be talking to Canary writers Steve Topple and Sophia Akram, and one of our weekend editors, Emily Apple. We're going to take a look at the potential deal between the Conservative Party and the DUP, what that means for the public purse. We're also going to think about a new piece of shocking news that we've heard about sell-off of part of our NHS. And finally, we'll take a look at the first PMQs after the election and just have a little look forward and see, you know, how are things panning out so far? So welcome, everybody. Really great to have you here for the podcast today. Let's start with Steve, shall we? Steve, this deal with the DUP is sort of very quietly ticking along in the background, and we've heard some pretty shocking news this week about what that might involve. Tell us a bit about that.
Indeed. Okay. So on Monday, we finally got the details of the supply and confidence agreement between the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, and the Conservative. Some of it was unsurprising. The details included the fact that the DUP will agree to support the government on any motions of confidence in them. It will support them on the Queen's Speech, as it has been doing. It will support them on budget, finance bills, anything to do with money, supply legislation. And also, quite crucially, it will support them on Brexit negotiations, where the two party stances are quite similar.
So is this a coalition by any other name?
Yeah, we had this debate in the newsroom, actually, yesterday.
And what did you conclude?
Essentially, it is a coalition by any other name, but obviously the official title is Confidence and Supply Agreement, because any other matters outside of what I've just mentioned will be on a case-to-case basis. However, I mean, when you look at the sort of mantras and the socio-economic stances of both these parties, they are fairly similar anyway. I think it is a coalition, albeit one which they can't formally call it that as such.
So, well, you say they're sort of socially and economically fairly similar. There's been quite a bit of criticism about the DUP's stance, particularly on climate change, but also on some social policy as well. Has that been dealt with in any of this discussion?
Absolutely. No, there's nothing that I can find. I mean, I've read through the whole confidence and supply agreement. I've also read through the fiscal and economic agreement. Obviously, the issues we're discussing here in terms of the social aspects are the DUP stance on LGBTQ plus rights and their stance on abortion in Northern Ireland. I know that Labour's Stella Creasy is pushing an amendment to the Queen's speech on Thursday, just gone. So when this podcast is broadcast, we may have the results of that, to try and sort out the issue of abortion in Northern Ireland, because the DUP are vehemently anti-abortion, and the historically they also have severe issues around minorities' rights, especially the same-sex marriage issue. So there are those differences there. But I mean, look, if you look at the Conservative Party more broadly, there are kind of two factions within it anyway. You have the more socially liberal elements of the Tories, which is broadly more in line with historically how Conservatives have been. The likes of Ken Clark are fairly socially liberal. Theresa May kind of has presented herself with this new Conservative government as being more socially liberal, if you like, than, say, her predecessor David Cameron was. It's very much about community and country and what have you. However, the undercurrents within the Tories are still, they are sometimes socially backwards. So, however, the DUP are extreme with this, obviously, and that is something which is going to have to be dealt with, because, I mean, the Tories have 11 gay MPs, I believe. Obviously, there's the abortion issue. So I think that's something which we're as yet to see come to a head, if you like.
That sounds like a potential minefield. But the real shock we've had this week is just how much public money this deal is going to cost.
Absolutely. Okay, so what we found out was that to secure this dodgy deal, if you like, there's been a somewhat of a golden handshake between the Tories and the DUP. The Tories have agreed to funnel $1 billion of extra money and $500 million of previously agreed money into Northern Ireland to secure this deal. Now, obviously, the sort of main takeaway from that was that Theresa May announced after she won the election that austerity was essentially over. However, just on Wednesday, the Tories blocked a Labour amendment saying that the public sector pay cap would be lifted. So what we've seen is the Tories managing to find £1.5 billion down the back of the proverbial sofa to give to Northern Ireland to secure this deal with the DUP, and yet they can't lift the public sector pay cap, which has seen people like nurses lose 14% of their real pay since 2010.
Forget down the back of the sofa. This is the proverbial money tree that we've been hearing about. You know, the idea that the Labour manifesto's promise to put private services back into public ownership for things like travel, water, energy. And people saying, well, you know, that's hardly possible because, you know, Corbyn's got this magic money tree that he's created in his mind, like he's some kind of Jack and the Beanstalk. But somehow May's Conservative government can find $1.5 billion. Where's that going to come from? I mean, you know, notwithstanding the fact that Northern Ireland has been severely neglected in terms of economic development over the last couple of parliaments, but you know, where does 1.5 billion come from?
No, absolutely. And they haven't released details of that yet. I think there's three important points to be made on this. Firstly, you're correct. Northern Ireland is the most underfunded nation of the four in the UK. It's been underfunded for decades, ignored by successive governments. And there are severe issues there regarding health, infrastructure, poverty and deprivation and infrastructure as well. The second point, if you like, though, is again, it's back to this magic money tree. But of course, we all know that money can be made out of thin air anyway. It was quite interesting. Richard Murphy, the tax expert, who's a sort of democratic socialist, if you like, person when it comes to his views on economics, he went all a bit anarchist the other day in a blog and did this short ranty blog about why the BBC keep asking where this money keeps coming from. And he repeatedly said, money is made out of thin air. The government repeatedly makes money out of thin air, and this money will be coming from thin air.
So money out of thin air, I mean, we could describe quantitative easing as money out of thin air. Is that what this is?
Yeah, essentially. They still haven't released details of where this money will be coming from. But I mean, it could be that the Bank of England will create bonds to sell to then funnel this money into Northern Ireland. It could be that the money will be taken from other areas of the budget. Who knows? We're waiting to see. But essentially, there's a deeper argument here about our whole financial system and how money is created and distributed anyway, which I don't think, if we went into that today, this podcast could be 3 hours long. So we'll park that issue.
I think yet again we might be recommending Steve Keen's book Debunking Economics, which is a brilliant run through how those particular systems work. And obviously our editor-in-chief, Kerry-Anne Mendoza, also has a book out called Austerity, which looks at the impact of austerity politics that follow some of those economic decisions.
There's just one more important point I want to make on this briefly. The third point about this 1.5 billion is where it's going to be going. Now, if you look at Northern Ireland, historically and currently, there is a great divide in infrastructure spending between the Protestant east of the country and the mainly Catholic west of the country. And it's been revealed that this 400 million is essentially mostly going to an infrastructure project in the Protestant East. Now, there's been mutterings about how this coalition of chaos will affect the Good Friday Agreement, how it will affect negotiations pertaining to that. And it would seem already that the decisions being made by the Tories and the DUP are being driven down sectarian lines, if you like. I mean, as I say, historically, there is a real problem with an East-West Protestant-Catholic divide when it comes to government and Northern Ireland executive spending. And this seems like it's just going to be exacerbated by the money that's being now funneled by the Tories in this golden handshake to the DUP into Northern Ireland. So, again, it's something else that needs to be kept a very close eye on.
I mean, there has been a question all along about whether a coalition with the DUP or some kind of agreement with the DUP would actually be contrary to the Good Friday Agreement anyway, because the Good Friday Agreement, correct me if I'm wrong about this, the Good Friday Agreement says that the UK government cannot give preferential treatment to either side of the historic troubles in Northern Ireland. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the government and the Tories have been quite specific about this in the confidence and supply agreement that they published. They said that the Conservative Party, while it will never be neutral in support for expressing its union, they'll still uphold the consent principle and democratic wishes of the people of Northern Ireland, and they will still fully adhere to their respective commitments that were laid out in the Belfast Agreement and the successors to that agreement. And it also explicitly states that the DUP will remain, as it always has been, an independent party exterior to any governmental decisions regarding this. But of course, I mean, this couldn't have come at a worse time, really. Northern Ireland Executive is in chaos as it is. Stormont is in chaos again. We're waiting to hear on Thursday, the 29th of June, what is happening with that, because we're at a crucial point now where if an agreement cannot be reached between the various parties in Northern Ireland, then the UK government is going to be taking back control of the Northern Irish Executive and Northern Irish Parliament. I mean, if you kind of take a step back and look at this, it's chaotic for a number of reasons, but the biggest implications that we're not really hearing much about and that we get to see pan out is what is going to happen with the Northern Ireland peace process and also sectarian divisions that already exist within the country. I think that's a story that's yet to unfold, if you like.
I don't think we're going to be seeing Sinn Féin taking their seats in Parliament just yet, though.
I don't think so. I mean, those mutterings, the Sun sort of had a field day when Sinn Féin flew into Westminster to sort out their offices. I think that was over-egged slightly. I can't see them still taking their seats, because it goes against every underlying principle the party has, if you like. So, but it's going to be, for want of a better phrase, an interesting few months.
Indeed. I'd like to move on to Sophia. Sophia, you've been looking at a decision that has been taken to sell off part of our NHS. Now, this is a part of the NHS which has been running efficiently. It's actually been saving the NHS quite a significant amount of money, yet a decision's been taken to move it to the private sector. Sophia, can you just take us through some of the background, please?
Basically, that story is, quite rightly, about a sell-off of a part of the NHS. It's a part that supplies staff to about a quarter of NHS trusts in the country, called NHS Professionals. And just to explain a little bit about what NHS Professionals is, it's essentially a staffing agency which provides NHS staff, doctors, nurses, midwives, admin staff, to different NHS trusts depending on their need. So it's based on a model of flexibility.
I think this is what people often will have heard of as being a bank staff member, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, up until now, the agency's been a success story. So it was originally set up as a non-profit making body in 2001, precisely in response to some of the controversies around using private temporary agency staff to fill gaps in staffing in the NHS. So at the time, there's kind of a big scandal. In particular, one of Blair's allies was running a temping agency for the NHS and doing what I think...
That's great.
I think the National Audit Office actually accused the agency of literally holding the NHS to ransom because they were taking advantage of staff shortages, their desperation for staff, and just charging them sky-high prices.
But our democratic memory is incredibly short. I mean, you know, that's probably long enough ago now that, you know, nobody is aware of any lessons that could have been learnt, and they're just ploughing on with this latest decision.
Yeah, so we're somewhat coming back full circle on it. So even though it started as a non-profit making body, it became a private entity in 2010 after the Tories came into power.
But still under public ownership?
Still under public ownership.
I don't quite understand that. How does that work?
So they've brought in CEOs from McKinsey and Virgin to sort of take over the running costs, etc. So actually, they still have managed to keep agency staff costs low, and they've still managed to turn over a profit. So they've still essentially managed to save around £70 million in comparison to other private sector agencies.
So this is kind of the difference between bank NHS staff costs versus genuine sort of private agency workers.
Yeah, exactly.
70 million quid is not insignificant.
It isn't insignificant. And the idea is, the reason for the sell-off is that they think the model's so successful, they want to expand it. So at the moment, it's currently servicing about a quarter of trusts in the country.
Okay.
And they want to sort of expand that to cover a greater number. And they're saying they're protecting that kind of mission statement of keeping costs low by retaining that 25% stake. So they're only selling off 75% of the company. And there's like caveats to say that they'll take back ownership if, you know, the whoever takes over the contract doesn't sort of fulfill that mission statement.
But so what is that? Is the mission to make a profit? Is the mission to save the NHS money? You know, what is that mission?
Yeah, exactly. It's to save the NHS money, to manage basically the kind of market for agency staff. So by increasing that competition amongst the private sector, it's keeping generally, apparently, fees low.
So if this is keeping fees low, it's designed to save the NHS money, what's the problem?
Obviously, it's now raising concerns, like to sell this company off straight off to the private sector. Firstly, because actually people have said that the amount has been valued at about £50 million is quite low. And that's supposed to be an immediate cash injection for the NHS. So, you know, people are sort of questioning why it's such a low figure, considering the amount of savings it's making for the government. Then obviously there's this natural scepticism of, you know, the trajectory we're on anyway of continuing to privatise bits of our NHS. And a lot of people have just assumed that, you know, temping fees will go up, and this is going to be the extra burden to trust budgets.
And what about workers? I mean, there's presumably under this current system, it's basically a non-profit making organisation, or it certainly has been in the past. Which obviously, you know, it reduces the temptation for lots of costs to be, you know, passed on to the hospital trusts and sucked up by the agency, leaving the workers on, you know, the absolute minimum possible wage for their time. Is there any evidence that this will affect that kind of differential?
No, not really. The problem is with that sort of judging the company on its record is a lot of this information is commercially sensitive. So even like when we look at some of the bidders for this tender, one of the ones that have been identified is Staffline, and they've already got contracts with the government. So they're working with Department of Work and Pensions to deliver what used to be called Action for Employment, like work programs encouraging people back into work. And I think they have another government contract with the probation service. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's no like evidence of how much that's cost the government, because like DWP accounts they're really difficult to understand. I mean, a lot of these programs are sort of grouped together, so it's difficult to see what individual suppliers are costing. And like, because of the commercial sensitivity, like they don't have to release that information.
Right.
I mean, it's fair enough, even if they continue their record of keeping agency staff fees low, they're increasing the number of temping staff that they're supplying to these trusts and wards. So, you know, in the early years of when NHS professionals emerged, they were providing around 50,000 staff across 77 different wards. Now they're supplying over 90,000 staff to around 55 wards and trusts.
Gosh.
But 60% of those assignments are actually covering empty vacancies. So it kind of begs the question of, what are they doing about, you know, structural problems within the NHS, like a staffing crisis? And why aren't they sort of investing that time and money into, you know,
training and recruiting people?
Exactly.
I'm sitting listening to this, and you know, my background is in science communication, and one of the topics that keeps coming back round for me is the issue of antimicrobial resistance. And we saw this sort of huge rise in hospital-acquired infections that were resistant to antibiotics, kind of in the sort of early 2000s. And one of the things that was really interesting about that was the difference between hospitals that had their own cleaning staff and hospitals that used agencies for their cleaning staff. And actually, there was really good evidence to say that the people who kind of had ownership of the hospital and had their bit that they worked on every day, that they could kind of go in and make pristine and sparkling and be confident that it was clean and safe for patients, it was very, very different to agency staff who, you know, had less job security, were probably being paid less, you know, didn't you know, have a sense of working for the hospital or even the NHS. And we are talking about agency staff. We're talking about people who would previously have worked for something called NHS professionals, who I guess now may be working for, you know, Virgin or you know, G4S or Circle, or, you know, whoever gets this contract. That really worries me. That, you know.
Yeah, I think there is this sort of thing of obviously continuity, like these temping staff will be like moving between different trusts and hospitals, and you know, there isn't that sort of continuation that you get with permanent members of staff. But also I think there's been an issue with quality and competence of agency staff just because of the training that their company might provide them, and I think that's a problem sort of whenever we talk about privatization. And we've seen it like with the privatization of detention centers and the prison service, and you know, quality and standards and accountability really goes down. So which is another thing actually why the agency was originally set up, was not just sort of an operational kind of role, it had like a strategic role as well, because obviously it recognized the need for occasionally there to be temporary staff to fill in, you know, gaps. Sure. And that flexibility model worked really well, but there needed to be some sort of standardized code of conduct, as it were. So,
and obviously, you know, flexible working is better for some people than a sort of regular
absolutely
job. But you know, for most people, what they're looking for is this kind of security. So, you know, it seems there are really multiple problems with this proposal. If you were to bottom line it, what do you think the government is actually seeking to get from this move?
Yeah, I think it's basically a continuation of the trajectory this government is sort of going down anyway towards privatising bits of the NHS and relinquishing control. Possibly, you know, we might be heading to a position where, you know, we've heard it, NHS no longer free at the point of use, you know.
It is difficult to ignore that as a potential endpoint. Something of a slippery slope, we might say.
Yeah.
Goodness me. Well, that strikes me as not great news.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on as well, because I think, like, with a lot of issues, there's so much that's sort of keeping us occupied and worrying us. There's a lot of drama coming out of Westminster, and it's really easy to keep our eye off the ball. And these things essentially are sort of carrying on without the scrutiny of Parliament. So, and I think, like, in some sense, the public are kind of used to, they're sort of expecting this. Like, I don't think it surprises anybody anymore. So in a way, we're kind of becoming, in my opinion, this is just my perspective, becoming a little bit more complacent about the way things are heading.
This certainly feels like something I'm going to be writing to my MP about.
Yeah.
Sophia, thank you so much for taking us through that.
No worries.
We're going to break very, very quickly now, just for me to give you a couple of little housekeeping messages. Thank you for listening to Canary Pod. To support us and ensure that our podcast gets seen by as many people as possible, please do subscribe and rate and review on the podcast platform that you prefer. That's really the only way that we're going to get our numbers up, and we want to reach as many people as possible. And if you would like to get in touch, we'd love to hear your feedback. You can get us on Twitter at CanaryPod or email podcast@thecanary.co. Thanks. Welcome back to this week's Canary Pod. I'm going to move on now and ask Emily Apple to talk to us a little bit about PMQs this week. Now, this is the first PMQs after the election and the Queen's speech has been discussed. I watched some of it, and to be honest, I was left a little bit open-mouthed. Emily, what was your reaction?
Well, yes. I mean, for a start, it was actually quite bizarre to hear Theresa May actually having to answer questions, even though she didn't answer them very well, having hidden from answering any questions at all during the election campaign. But she then just continued in the same way that she's always done, by obfuscating, by lying. Unsurprisingly, a lot of PMQs was dominated by the absolute tragedy at Grenfell about the impact of austerity in that tragedy and the attack on the working classes in that tragedy. But Theresa May kept trying to deny it, and she kept saying, oh, you know, it wasn't a question of regulations, it was a question of why so many local authorities weren't sticking to them. And Corbyn basically trapped her, and he just said to her, you know, that he thinks he can help her, you know, and told her that she cut local authority expenditure by 40%, and if you do that, you end up with fewer building control inspectors.
Honestly, the more I listen to this stuff, the more I feel like I'm in some kind of dystopian novel. I mean, you know, you said earlier on, you know, she lied, she didn't answer questions. Yep. I mean, to me, having kind of looked at the Queen's speech and followed the manifesto through the election and, you know, digested a bit about, you know, the policies gone past, it was pretty obvious that she was lying. I mean, she wasn't just avoiding the question. She was actually out and out lying.
Yes. Yes. So, for example, she said that the cladding started under Tony Blair when it started under Margaret Thatcher. You know, and she kept trying to claim it was matters that occurred under governments of both colours, as well as councils of both political persuasions. She's really trying to shift the blame from the fact that her government did nothing. And it is an absolute disgrace. Her chief of staff, Gavin Barwell, who lost his seat at the election, who was the housing minister, said in 2016 they'd be looking into the recommendations on fire safety in due course. This is a government that has done nothing and hasn't cared, has cut local authority expenditure by 40%. And then she has the cheek to stand up in Parliament after that absolutely devastating election result for her, and to continue lying and to continue coming out with the same stuff as before, as if nothing had changed. It's kind of like she hasn't even accepted this election result at all.
It's complete doublespeak. I honestly don't think I've ever heard anything like it. And I mean, we say she's like at absolute best, she's at least woefully ill-informed of the history of politics in the UK and of the decisions made by the Conservative government and Conservative councils, which, you know, does not say to me that this is a woman who's got in her hands the knowledge and the understanding and the power to make some of the absolutely vital decisions that she is going to have to make over the next couple of years. Does anyone else want to chip in on sort of initial reactions to PMQs this week, if you got to hear it?
Yeah, I think, like, just reiterating a lot of what Emily said is that I was just quite alarmed at how much she didn't answer, and with what did dominate on Grenfell, like the amount of alternative facts that she had at hand, and just kind of like following on from what we can expect on that, like she was saying that a public inquiry would be underway and a Chief Justice would be appointing a judge, and I actually read this morning about who that judge would be, and it is slightly concerning, like considering some of the past decisions he's had on housing issues, on immigration issues as well. I'm not sure if, like, considering this was supposed to be an inclusive inquiry with the community surrounding Grenfell, what they might have to say about that particular choice.
Yeah, if I was a resident of Grenfell right now, I'd be having some pretty serious doubts about getting answers anytime soon. But, you know, this is part of a wider political landscape, and how in the last year have we ended up with Trump in office in the US, a vote for Brexit, and this Conservative minority government led by somebody who is looking more and more incompetent? Like, how on earth did we get there?
I think the challenge is, and this is a narrative which we're not hearing, and it's one I keep banging on about, I'm afraid. So it's a bit left field, get ready.
Okay.
We got here for the same reasons, in my opinion, that Grenfell Tower happened. Partly we got here because people understand and they feel that the political class isn't working for them. However, they don't know the best way to object and to make their voices heard on that. Therefore, we have Trump elected in the US. We have the narratives from the likes of UKIP becoming prominent, so that led to Brexit. However, there's this bigger issue around Grenfell Tower, and no one wants to talk about it because it's so unpleasant and such a dismaying truth, if you like. It just, what Grenfell Tower encapsulates for me, and I've said this many times, is the utter contempt and disregard that exists in UK society for the poorest and the underclass that live in this country. And the thing is, I've seen Guardian commentators, I've seen other left-wing commentators go, oh, this is a neoliberal issue. This is not a neoliberal issue. This is something which is entrenched and ingrained in UK society over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. You can go back to the feudal system, Victorian times. There is this them and us, establishment, political class, and the underclass that are ignored, vilified, disregarded, not listened to. And this sums this up. And the challenge with especially what the likes of Corbyn are saying, while it's refreshing to hear a politician speak how he does, we have to bear in mind that at grassroots level, his Labour councils are no better than the Conservative ones. I wrote a piece last year about Newham Council, which is one of the worst offenders for social cleansing. And on that council was a councillor who was fined by his own council for breaches of fire regulations and building regulations in a property that he let. Now, this is not the problem with Theresa May trying to depoliticise it, which is what she was doing, is unfortunately that is what we need to be doing, because Labour councils are just as complicit and compliant in the abuse of social and council housing tenants as Tory ones are.
I think that really highlights an important point, which is that, you know, historically in this country, what we've talked about was a rule of the aristocracy. And that's something which I think has changed since the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, which is that actually, you know, if you're upper class and you went to Eton, it sort of helps. You know, you've got a definitely a leg up. But actually what seems to be more important is wealth. And we're in a situation now where actually the ruling classes are not necessarily a sort of classical aristocratic kind of inherited wealth and station. And actually what we're seeing now is much more about corporations and about people, you know, individual wealth. It's sort of Thatcher's self-made man now can be in a position to rule. And it's, you know, it's unsurprising really that, you know, we're hearing these examples from across the political elite, where, you know, that power, the power that comes from ownership and from wealth, you know, effectively has corrupted the proper behaviour and the kind of respect for human rights that we've come to respect from a left-wing politics.
No, absolutely. I mean, the thing is what Naomi Klein and people before her describe as corporatism is essentially what we have now. But my point is that while it takes many different guises, that attitude and sentiment is ingrained within UK society. I mean, if you look at France, for example, the public in France don't take no crap. If they're not happy about something, their politicians and government know about it. Whereas we have this almost built-in mechanism within us in the UK that we're servile and that we can't question authority and that what people in charge say, oh, well, they must be right and we must listen to them. But as I came to on my original point, I think people are starting to realise that that is not the case. However, they're channeling their frustration and their anger in quite often the wrong direction. And that's why we've seen the rise of Trump in the US, the rise of UKIP and this far right narrative in the UK.
So one of the things that we talk about a lot at the Canary is action, is people taking the actions that can bring the sort of change that they're seeking to experience. But I suppose, you know, the flip side of that is also responsibility. And I think, you know, what you say, Steve, is absolutely bang on. And I think people do kind of submit to authority. But part of that, I think, is this kind of feeling that we're waiting for the cavalry to arrive. And we're waiting for someone to come and sort it out for us. And I think it's you know, it's quite clear that that's not happening. I mean, many of us who, you know, seek to have a fairer and more equal society, you know, look to Jeremy Corbyn as somebody who could potentially lead a government that, you know, had an interest in making that so. But, you know, as Steve's pointed out, you know, Corbyn is part of a much broader kind of political movement within the Labour Party. And, you know, that is neoliberal in its essence. You know, there are still going to be people who, you know, will cling to the status quo to a more or less extent. So what do we need?
Well, I think, I mean, I agree with everything that you've both just been saying. And for me, as much as I like hearing what Corbyn is saying, I think we still need to come back to grassroots organising. We're in a position where we've got a minority Conservative government. We've got a Tory party who laughed after they won the vote on not giving public sector workers a pay rise.
It's just gross.
And we need to respond to that. We don't need to wait for Corbyn and the Labour Party to respond to that. We as individuals need to respond to that. We need to respond to it with protests. We need to respond to it with strikes. And we need to respond to it with building our own alternatives within our own communities. Yeah. We need to be that change that we want to see. And it's a cliche, but it's true. We need to be out there creating the kind of cooperative, fair, equal groups, ideas, you know, all those kind of things, skill sharing, opening up buildings for people to live in, and empowering people to have control over their lives. Because part of this is this belief that A, the cavalry will come, B, about being subservient, but also about us not feeling that we have control to make that change, that we make that change through putting a cross in a box every 5 years. Yeah. That's not how change comes. Change comes through us doing things and taking back that control. And that's what we need to start doing now.
And that comes on you know, on a small and a grand level too. I mean, there's lots that you can do to make very small changes that incrementally become big changes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think something actually that the response to Grenfell actually showed is how much grassroots is so important. I've never seen like such a sort of powerful response. I think that's partly the reason why, you know, Theresa May has to be seen to be acting, why there is a public inquiry, and why she has got, you know, questions to answer. It's literally the community. They took over the media. You know, they were demanding answers. So, I mean, I think that just kind of highlights that, you know, in the extreme.
I don't disagree with any of what's been said. There's part of me, sadly, which thinks that are we too far gone? And is this such a global issue? Because that's what we also need to bear in mind. We're only an island within a corporatist now system, which stretches across the four corners of the world. Are we too far gone? However, I do agree community organising is important, because I think if you put it in the context of the general election, the demographics of the vote, the majority of those in socioeconomic status D, as in the working class and the underclass, the majority of people voted Conservative. So Jeremy Corbyn's message ain't reaching the working classes in this country. And that can only be changed, and this is where I agree with Emily, if communities start organising themselves and changing the discourse and the conversations that are being had on a ground zero grassroots level.
And to just, you know, to have it that it's completely unacceptable to scapegoat those who are even poorer and even more in need. You know, the idea that, you know, you're somebody who's living in poverty and you look over and you see someone fleeing a war zone seeking asylum, and rather than seeing another human being who requires compassion and love and being taken care of, you see, you know, Schrodinger's immigrant who is simultaneously stealing your job and on benefits. And I think, you know, that all it takes is to start that conversation just with one other person.
That is crucial, because what the establishment class and what the corporatist class rely on is the fact that the rest of us are divided, and that we cannot agree and that we are turning on each other. As we all know, it's a classic tactic. But it also, it bizarrely needs to extend somewhat the other way, because the class system has been so decimated in this country. You have people who consider themselves middle class, if you like, who are actually, in essence, working class. It's just that the economic and the financial system has made them somehow slightly better than the rest of us. It needs to work that way as well, because otherwise, again, we will not see a change. The middle classes need to be shocked or affected or got on board, if you like, before anything major is going to happen, because otherwise we'll we're down to a smaller demographic, a smaller group of people.
So, you know, clearly there's actions for us to take. We can write to our MPs about the selling off of NHS professionals. We can get out and we can protest. We can withdraw our labour. We can strike. And we can do some really, really simple things. We can take care of somebody. We can have a conversation that is different from the usual conversation that we have. Don't be scared that people will go, oh, you're talking about politics again. No, you're talking about the things that affect people day in, day out. And just to change that conversation, we can stop scapegoating people who are in even more need and build a world that works for everyone, which I think is a great note to end this week's podcast on. And to remind you, don't get angry, get involved.